Yeah, we're in the studio here with Noah Morris and Roger Benham. Welcome. You want to say hi?
Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
All right. Sounds pretty good. We don't have headphones either, so bear with us for some audio issues. Noah and Roger came into the city for the weekend for the Katrina 10 anniversary. Can you tell us what brought you here?
Sure. Both of us were co-founders of the Common Ground Health Clinic in Algiers, which is about to have its own 10-year anniversary on September 9th. And we came back to see how the city was evolving. I moved away 4 years ago myself and came to visit with folks and hang out.
Yeah, Noah spent a lot more time in the city than I did. I never lived here after the storm. I just came in back and forth a bit, but I felt like I really needed to. It's been about 3 years since I've been here before, and I really wanted to come back and see how things were.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing now that you're not here in the city, and maybe what your perspective is now that you visited?
Sure. Well, I continue to work on frontline medical solidarity issues, doing trainings for different groups and nations that are organizing civil disobedience against various forms of extraction, working with a lot of really amazing organizations out there like Oweaku out of Lakota Territory, who are fighting uranium and pipeline issues, Utah Tar Sands Resistance and Canyon County Rising Tide, who are fighting the first U.S. oil sands mine, out on the Colorado Plateau, and also doing some work with some folks from Diné Ta, so-called Navajo Territory, who are working on reinvigorating the grassroots people on their land around, now the Animas mine spill in the Animas River, as well as lingering uranium pollution and radiation on their land, and fighting Peabody coal as well.
And I live in southern New England, so the big issues that we've been working on most recently there are they want to expand a pre-existing gas pipeline to transport fracked gas from the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania, supposedly for domestic southern New England consumption, but all the signs are there that the long-range game for that is to export the natural gas to Europe. So fighting those struggles connected to what's going on in Pennsylvania and the construction of other export facilities in Maryland is something that I've been involved with most recently. And also in where I live in Connecticut, in Hartford, there has been a pretty significant for that area Black Lives Matter movement that's emerging in Hartford with some older community organizers from the community getting involved with younger people, and that's kind of taking off in more radical directions just this year. So those are the two things that I've been working on in Connecticut, southern New England.
So I met you both doing street medic training. Is that something that you're continuing to do with those groups?
Yeah, a little bit atypical presentation of it just because of the nature of the different struggles on the front lines in different parts of the country, but doing a lot of trainings for folks to be prepared to help each other out in the face of police violence when they're blockading pipelines and otherwise resisting the expansion of these extreme extractive industries, like the in-situ uranium mining in Nebraska, the desire to continue mining in the Black Hills, desire to continue to strip mine Black Mesa. You know, all these things, the fight looks a little bit different because these are really rural areas. A lot of these are native reservations. And so what their challenges and their experiences make it slightly different than urban-based activities. But, yeah.
And so for listeners that are unfamiliar, do you want to just like kind of speak to the heart of doing health work in spaces where it's like not supposed to be?
Yeah, well, we're part of this movement that's called this we call it the street medic movement. Other people call it action medic, but basically it's just people that provide first aid at the most basic level, first aid at protests and at mobilizations. But so it also goes beyond that, providing community health. We generally do a weekend-long training, and that's the one that you went to in New Orleans with Noah and I a few years ago. And that just gives people basic first aid skills and also allows them to recognize how to support people that are dealing with some basic chronic health conditions, sometimes we'll have an herbal component or a harm reduction component, depending on what the needs are of the local community. And then kind of going off that, people can learn more, go ahead and get regular certifications like wilderness first responder. Some people go on to get emergency medical technician training, go on and move far beyond the street medic network. But we just have always wanted to train a certain body of people that are interested in social change and in direct action, and enable them to be able to help their comrades and their friends when they're in the street. And we continue with those trainings on a regular basis as the need arises. Excuse me. Obviously, 10 years ago here in New Orleans, we, as street medics, a lot of us had different levels of certification that were beyond that, moved far beyond that to helping to provide direct public health services in the city. And since then, a lot of us have gone on to do similar work, not just in directly politically, what I think you could call directly politically motivated things like what Noah was just talking about, but also in other disasters where we're providing public health to the generally underserved populations. So street medics went to Haiti after the earthquake in 2011. Street medics responded to Superstorm Sandy in New York City, in the public housing projects in the Rockaways and Coney Island in 2012. Street medics responded to the Galveston hurricane. What was that called?
Gustav,
yeah, in 2008.
Yep.
So a lot of people who have gotten into the street medic scene have seen that, like, oh, we can also apply these skills, not just in a protest situation, but also responding in other disasters alongside other responders. And as we respond alongside other responders, we bring, as political activists and as people concerned with issues of climate justice and racial justice, we bring a perspective into those disaster responses, which, in my experience, isn't seen generally by the other responding organizations.
I'd also add one of the main important reasons we exist and have existed for the past 40, 50 years is because traditionally EMS isn't allowed into scenes that are deemed unsecure by law enforcement or state apparatus when they use riot agents or otherwise use physical force against demonstrators and whatnot. These activists and protesters and community members typically aren't allowed to get medical aid because EMS isn't allowed in because they say the scene isn't safe. So this has been one of the real needs that street medics have jumped into the void of, to provide that comrade-to-comrade healthcare in the streets, keep folks on the line, put folks back on the line so we can continue to hold these lines and hold space. And it's a really good aspect of solidarity to help demystify the fear of the police weapons, as well as be like, hey, we're here, we got your back, go push a little harder.
Right, and I think that listeners that are maybe unfamiliar with protest environments or any of the, like, tar sands actions, pipeline actions, would be able to relate to kind of the street medic culture, which would be, like, considering, like, self-motivated interest in your own health and, like, having tools available to take care of that, but also being part of an environment that's, like, lifting you up to that. I think that that can involve a lot of different formulas of, like, where it's maybe not condoned or supported for individuals to be, like, concerned about their health and well-being, that, you know, we get this kind of collective experience where we can talk about it and we can support one another. But I wanted to draw some parallels between the work that you have been doing in the last 10 years, including Hurricane Katrina, and where we're at now in terms of Louisiana being a place of oil production. So in Mayor Mitch Landrieu's Katrina 10 anniversary, I just want to play this quick quote from him. He says that here we go, I'll just play.
Nature, you're not. So our hurricane evacuation plans are better, our building plans are better, but this is where the coast comes in too. The coast that you hear us talk so much about, that protects the oil and gas infrastructure, that protects the nation's national security and energy security, also protects the physical space of New Orleans, because as the storms come in, if that coast retreats, the storm surge is higher, and that storm is not only the protector of the cultures and the people that live there, but it's also the buffer for New Orleans. So the coast is important, the levees are important, rebuilding is important, having a plan is important, all of those things, and that's why the Corps of Engineers...
So I'm going to stop right there. I just thought it was really interesting that he wanted to bring up national security related to oil. And like as a side note, it'll protect communities. I wanted to see if you could speak to your experience with Hurricane Katrina, but also with the work that you've been doing now toward our position in that.
Well, I mean, I also worked on the BP oil spill as an EMT while I still live down here. And I think Mitch Landrieu or anyone else speaking about the need to continue the development of oil and gas infrastructure in this country as an idea of national security is ludicrous. I think what we need to do is secure the clean drinking water in this country and in this continent, and we need to actively be decommissioning these refineries and these power plants rather than continuing to expand and go deeper and deeper into deeper water. And we saw how great that went with the Deep Horizon. And, you know, more extreme stuff like Shell about to be drilling in the Arctic, where they don't have, they literally have no plan as to what they do if there's a spill. You know, the continued expansions of things like the Keystone XL and the Alberta tar sands is only going to endanger not just the current generations alive now, but the future generations won't have that clean drinking water. They won't have the infrastructure left to be using the gas and oil. And most of this expansion is going for, you know, international sale. We're saying it's going to make us nationally, you know, sovereign from international oil dependency, but that's not true because we're selling that. We're not using that for national interests. We're using that for capitalist interests, and capitalists don't have anyone's interests but their own at heart.
I think for me, kind of following on what Noah just said, it's kind of illustrated by coming back here, and this is the first time that I don't think 3 years ago that the Superdome was being sponsored by Mercedes-Benz. That was kind of shocking when I drove in from the airport. Noah drove me in from the airport the other night, and I saw that. And, you know, the image of the Superdome, having been here in 2005 and 2006, and that was such a symbol of the suffering and the, you know, the tenacity, but also the betrayal by the government of people in this city. And you just see that Mercedes-Benz Smoothie King Center thing, that was so symbolic to me. You know, everything that's happened with public education in New Orleans and the conversion to charter schools. Someone I was talking to yesterday, or the day before yesterday, was talking about how, you know, New Orleans, you can really look to New Orleans as being the future of the United States. They tried out a lot of ideas in the wake of Katrina here that they'd been wanting to try out for a while. And they were all ideas based upon market supremacy, upon capitalism. They're not based upon human needs. After Katrina, we were supposed to have a national conversation about race and racism. You know, that happens every few years, that there will be some incident that brings to the mainstream what's going on every day in communities of color and in, you know, in, whether they be reservations or whether they be inner cities or whether they be decaying suburbs. And then we have that national conversation for just a few short weeks, and then it gets co-opted all of a sudden into, well, we got to get back to normal. And the way to get back to normal is to privatize more and more services and to have these capitalist solutions. So we saw that after Katrina, and then we also saw that last year in Ferguson. What did everybody get upset about in Ferguson? Did people get upset about Michael Brown being shot and his body being left out there for 4 hours on the street? No, that happens every single day in the United States. What got people excited was when people reacted to that and burned down a few buildings. And then all of a sudden it was a major incident because property was being affected. So I'm not really surprised that Landrieu would say that about the primacy of property. It's very ironic that the property he's talking about is this oil infrastructure that Noah was just talking about, which directly results in more flooding and worse storm surges and worse hurricanes and worse storms. And, you know, drilling in the Arctic, like Noah mentioned, the only reason we can contemplate drilling in the Arctic now is because the Arctic is melting, because we've already burnt so many fossil fuels. So we continually get trapped and recuperated into this conversation that just says capitalism is the only answer, putting company brands on, selling off our public assets and our public lands to corporations and to companies and to privatizing. And we completely devalue the human lives, the black lives, the lives of people who who don't have a place in that system. And so I think when we can bring, we're talking 10 years later, and we're still talking about, we're talking about issues of climate justice, we're talking about Black Lives Matter, these are directly the same issues that we were dealing with 10 years ago that were brought to light by Katrina. And the priorities that were placed on protecting property 10 years ago and shooting people because they were looting, when it turned out that there were all of these people all over the city and all over the region that were not getting the help they needed.
I mean, there are a lot of different lines of you know, we're hearing at this anniversary of like, this is better, that is better, this is better. One of the ones that annoys me the most thinking about safety is like that we have less crime, which was a few months ago. It was some data that was released and it said that property crimes were down. You know, we still have these like ridiculously high violence rates against human beings, right? But the headline is going to continue to be like, oh, well, we're safer because property crime is down.
Well, you know, lies, damn lies and statistics. You know, look at what they've actually done. Look at where they prioritize that crime fighting. I mean, folks remember that the Louisiana National Guard was brought in to guard neighborhoods like Chantilly and Uptown from copper thieves. While there's still massive amounts of crime, kids were coming back, no schools were open. They opened the Juvenile Justice Center before they opened any schools, really. We saw where their priorities was. St. Bernard Parish at least took their priority to make sure their kids could come back and have the school be one of the first things they reopened. And New Orleans didn't want the kids to come back. New Orleans didn't want the public housing residents to come back. And the fact that we're still here, come home. If you had to leave, come home. They don't want folks to come home who have left. We heard radio interviews about how there are less white people in town now, 10,000 less white people, but 110,000 less people in general. Well, why aren't we talking about those other missing 100,000 people? Is that because they're Cajun and Creole and black? You know, is that because they were on the lower side of the economic spectrum? You know, it's still about, you know, how the city's gotten whiter, or it's gotten a little bit more affluent. And you know, we're rebuilding. It's coming back. You know, new flavor to the gumbo. Without the recognition that folks who are like an old-growth forest in some of these neighborhoods have prevented from coming back, their, you know, generations of families have been split up and fractured. And that's not being addressed. Just like, you know, the youth were never given adequate mental health care after the fact. You want a direct link to probably some of the crime? Let's look at those 18-year-olds who were 8 getting walked out through that water, who are at the convention center and never got actual mental health care about that stuff because we were too busy rebuilding the CBD. We were too busy selling the Superdome to Mercedes-Benz or building a new hospital to then privatize. You know, the priorities have always been on, you know, the veneer, just like they would always film early on the Superdome with the West Bank behind it because the lights were on the West Bank. They filmed the Superdome looking at the East Bank. All the lights were off behind it.
Yeah, and I think that that's a special consideration to have as we move forward. I know there's already a website for the 2018 bicentennial of New Orleans. Like, it's, you know, another kind of Super Bowl citywide event of polishing that veneer. But what's beneath that, you know, there's no... no dominant narrative trying to expose that, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't want to end on a totally low low place. So I do want to move into kind of maybe some anecdotal experiences that y'all can share about, you know, people that are kind of pushing a narrative that is more real than that, and maybe doing the work that addresses some of these extraction issues.
Well, I mean, I just had the privilege of being on the Colorado River with these folks fighting the tar sands mine in Utah. And that was a camp that was rare in the environmental movement, unfortunately, and that was primarily populated by people of color and Native folks with a very small minority of white people. And we were able to have an action that both shut down operations at this mine and allow some of our Native comrades to go and have ceremony out there and have a water ceremony to heal some of the springs being poisoned out there. And it was good, solid white accomplices who actually sat in the tripods and blockaded the work site, who actually snuck up on the cherry picker and locked down to it while they were trying to extract people, and were able to hold that space for healing for the native community and the land there, and do that as good, you know, colonizer accomplices to these Red Nations folks. And seeing more of this, where the Red Nations and people of color are being put in a position of primacy and putting energetically and vociferously out front, but also when the need is there, having white bodies in front of them. So those folks are already over targeted and already, you know, disproportionately affected by these issues aren't the ones getting arrested as well. Because they're already fighting this in their own communities day in and day out, and their grandpas and grandmas and great-grandmas and grandpas have been doing this for generations. And, you know, the least we can do, especially as colonizers and settlers on this land, is take that effort to, you know, use our privilege and put that out front. And there's been a lot of that happening more effectively that I've been seeing. It's a real inspiring thing to get to see.
Yeah, in New Orleans, we've had a little bit more of an improvement in actions, where you do see white people taking a step back, but offering the tools that they have, which is like their bodies, to blockade. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that too. Did you have anything you wanted to share?
Oh, I was just going to add, you know, thinking back what it was like right after the storm here, and a lot of the folks that had stayed when I first arrived. You know, we all know what that population looked like, but it was a lot of folks that were too old to leave or didn't have the resources to leave. And I just remember in those days, you know, riding around and going door to door, meeting all of these elders that had not been able to leave, and the fact that they were still there was a really powerful and inspiring thing to me at the time. Just most recently, Noah reminded me that was 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, in the town I live in Connecticut, where they're going to expand this pipeline. A friend of mine did a lockdown where he blocked access to this big equipment yard where the Spectra Corporation, which is going to expand this gas pipeline, was storing all of their equipment for Connecticut. At the time he locked down, they had moved some of it out. But people don't do things like that in Eastern Connecticut, locked down to concrete barrels in such a way that the police just can't move them without hurting them. And so Vic had done this because it was his 75th birthday, and that was kind of an inspiring thing to all of us, that he'd want to go out, and he said, like, I'm 75 years old. I want to just use my remaining few years on this earth to stop this fossil fuel expansion and this extraction. I can see what it's been doing. I know what climate change has done and the change. So to me, that was very inspiring. It was inspiring to a lot of younger folks as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, I really want to thank you all for coming into the studio today. I want to say goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you so much.